This is the River Radius, a cultural nexus of rivers, people, and boats. I am your host, Sam Carter. Welcome.
I did always think that of all the dories that Martin named, the Emerald Mile had the most beautiful name of all. And I say that without ever having seen the place itself. And the name conjures up this image in my mind of like, I mean, can you imagine an entire mile of just a ribbon of emerald created by this canopy of some of the oldest living organisms on Earth arching over tea-colored water flowing through it? Like, it just sounds marvelous. And I always loved the name, and I hope I get a chance to go visit the place someday.
This episode is the first in a two-part series about what many river people consider to be one of the finest river books available for reading, The Emerald Mile. And there is a deep story about the place on this earth called The Emerald Mile. It is a forest with a creek with a story. River Radius contributing host Samara Rosen is our host for these two episodes exploring The Emerald Mile in all of its personas. Please welcome Samara Rosen.
This episode comes to you from three Emerald Miles. The first Emerald Mile is the book by Kevin Fedarko, a book that chronicles the 1983 speedrun through the Grand Canyon. The second Emerald Mile is the name of the wooden boat called a dory that they used in the speedrun and that inspired the name of the book. The third Emerald Mile is less well known. The Emerald Mile dory is named after a place, a serene creek cradled in old-growth redwoods in Northern California. The Emerald Mile Place launched a deep internet dive into the history of Redwood State and National Park, where I stumbled across the writings of a man, Dave Vandermark, and his epic adventures to include a tiny stretch of river, the Emerald Mile, in the boundaries of what became Redwood National Park in Northern California. So there are three Emerald Miles, the book, the dory, and the creek. This story spans two episodes of The River Radius. This episode, part one, looks at the impact of these names. Writing, poetry, and visceral imagery are all methods of celebrating, grieving, and protecting places we love. In a second episode, we explore the question, was the Emerald Mile truly lost? The Emerald Mile dory was part of a fleet named after places lost at the hand of mankind. But the Emerald Mile place was protected within the national park boundaries. To begin this first episode about the namesake of the Emerald Mile, we'll outline what Grand Canyon dories are, the process in which they were named, and the impact created from the words of this book by turning to the very author who wrote The Emerald Mile, the epic story of the fastest ride in history through the heart of the Grand Canyon. Please meet author and former Grand Canyon River guide, Kevin Fedarko.
My name is Kevin Fedarko. I make my living writing books primarily about the Grand Canyon. And my relationship with rivers is monogamous. My relationship is really to the Colorado River and to one specific segment of it, the 277-mile stretch of it that runs between Lee's Ferry and the Grand Wash Cliffs through the Grand Canyon.
I read in the back of your book that the Emerald Mile was a project that you were working on for about 10 years. And when thinking about undertaking a large project like that, there's always some sort of reason. Was there a moment in your guiding experience or connection to the Grand Canyon that inspired you to tell this story?
If there was a moment where I realized that there was a story to be told, it probably arrived over the course of my first or second summer as an apprentice river guide in Grand Canyon. You know, there's a ritual that unfolds on the river in the canyon, you know, after the sun has set and camp has been established. And it's a ritual that involves the boatmen, guides, and the apprentices usually going down to the boats, particularly if it's in the summer, although if it's in the shoulder seasons, you might be gathered around the campfire. But what people do is they tell stories about the river and the canyon. And it began to dawn on me that they all seem to tie back to the story of one particular season when a series of events unfolded on the Colorado River inside the canyon, creating the conditions for an enormous flood, a crisis at Glen Canyon Dam, and three boatmen who wanted to use those events to conduct a speed run through the canyon. But that would serve also as a kind of frame and template for a much larger and, in my mind, more important story about a very, very special place.
When you first had the idea of this book and you were pitching it to editors, publishers, give us the official book pitch. What's the plot? Why should we read it?
When you try and pitch a story to a book publisher, you're usually talking to people who are part of an industry that's located in New York City. They're not people who are typically connected to the environment or the landscape. And so when I pitched the story to these people in New York, I basically told them that this was an opportunity to place the story of this incredibly important landscape inside the confines of a 17-foot wooden boat. And that boat would carry the canyon, the Colorado River, and the readers along on an incredibly exciting journey, and would tell the story of this kind of turbocharged adventure that involved using the flood of 1983 as a kind of hydraulic slingshot to propel these three river guides from one end of the Grand Canyon to the other. But in the course of getting that story delivered to them, the readers of this book would be introduced to and connected to and seduced by the landscape and the river that were at the center of that adventure.
We are welcoming a new sponsor to the River Radius, Rocky Talkies. These are handheld radios made for running rivers when you want solid communication in whitewater, in rescues, when sharing information is key for your safety and success on the river. Rocky Talkie offers two radios, and the 5-watt radio, this radio, is waterproof and has stable connection range in river corridors well beyond your yelling, whistles, and binoculars. I use these on the river when running the scary rapids where I want to make sure my river partners and I will have the best runs, and I even like to use them when caravanning to the river. Would you like a discount for your Rocky Talkie 5-watt radio purchase? River Radius 10 for 10% off an entire order. River Radius 10. We have their web address and the discount code in our show notes. Over and out.
Downriver Equipment is a river gear company based in Denver, Colorado. Come to their shop in person or go online to www.downriverequip.com. Raftopia is Downriver's annual major river gear sale with new gear and used gear. Raftopia begins on April 2nd and culminates on Saturday, April 6th with an outdoor parking lot sales event with many of your favorite river gear companies on site in person. Personally, I will be at Raftopia working as the MC. Come on down, find great deals on river gear, and meet rad river people. Raftopia is happening in Denver, Colorado, Saturday, April 6th. Find Downriver online at www.downriverequip.com and in today's show notes.
Just a minute ago, you were talking about, you dance around it, you talk about wooden boats. Let's just dive right in. What are dories?
Well, a dory is a particular type of boat. Its place and time of invention is disputed with great spirit by historians. But one thing that a lot of people tend to agree on is that one central aspect of their design, which is a rockered flat bottom, came out of New England, the North Atlantic cod fishery in the late 18th and 19th centuries. It's very sturdy. The boats can stack like eggshells on the deck of a schooner. And there was something about the practicality and the sturdiness and the workability, the utilitarianness of these boats that meant that they were just adopted all over the place. But the particular boat that I kind of became focused on was a dory that was designed specifically to handle the really big whitewater that you find inside of Grand Canyon. That boat was commissioned by one man named Martin Litton, who was deeply involved with conservation in the Grand Canyon and was looking for a boat that was somewhat practical, but also embodied his ideas about beauty and aesthetics, because to Martin, that was an important part of moving through an experience in Grand Canyon. So the boat at the center of this book is the Grand Canyon Dory.
I have your book in front of me. There is this section that I am really intrigued by, and I'm wondering if we can elaborate on it.
Mm-hmm.
While rubber rafts were considerably more resilient and far easier to manage, they could be downright ugly. Fat, bulbous, and squishy, they lacked the dory's elegance and grace, qualities that were further enhanced by Litton's decision to paint each of the boats in the same colors, red, white, and turquoise, which supported the primary hues of the canyon, and they fit in beautifully. He also inaugurated a tradition of naming every craft after a natural wonder that, in his view, had heedlessly been ruined by the hand of man. To remind us of places we've destroyed without any necessity, he would bark to anyone who inquired, so that maybe we'll think twice before we do it again. Can you tell me a little bit about why Martin named boats after places heedlessly ruined by the hand of man?
Probably the most important thing to understand about Martin Litton is that he was an incredibly passionate conservationist who was deeply in love with the rivers and the mountains and the landscape, in particular of the West, and who dedicated a significant portion of his life to celebrating these landscapes, sharing them with others, and doing so with something specific in mind, which was to build a constituency of people who came to love those places like him so much that they were willing to protect them. And so all of these ideas came to a head in the dories that Martin commissioned and brought down into the Grand Canyon. Martin assigned a name to each boat. It's an incredibly important part of his story. Each dory in Martin's fleet was named after a natural wonder that had been destroyed by the hand of human beings. The Skagit or Celilo Falls, which were destroyed by dams. There were a bunch of those boats that were named after features that were once part of Glen Canyon, the canyon that sits directly upstream on the Colorado River from Grand Canyon, a place whose beauty was said to have surpassed that of the Grand Canyon itself before it was submerged between the waters of Lake Powell and drowned by the Glen Canyon Dam. So, you know, there was the Tickaboo, the Hidden Passage, Tapestry Wall. So what this meant was that these boats were named after places that we once had that have been lost. And what that did, at least in my view, is that it took these boats, which I described a moment ago, right? These are boats that were designed for their utilitarian principles. Well, what Martin did by assigning them these names was he injected an element of poetry into these tools. He married utilitarianism with beauty and longing and loss.
In naming these dories after places that are lost, do you know if there was any impact that came from Martin's poetry?
I'm not sure that I'm aware of a direct relationship between naming those boats and saving a particular place.
Maybe a parallel question is, do you know what the impact of your book is?
One small thing I have heard. I've been told that the book, for reasons that are a bit of a mystery to me, because to be just brutally candid here, I'm not a huge fan of my own writing. It apparently speaks to people who are on the river that leads many of them to carry it with them on, you know, a Colorado River trip. And I'm told that if you go on the river, that in many camps at night, you will find people reading it or reading to one another from it around the campfire or sitting on the decks of the boat.
I can attest to how many copies I've seen in ammo cans. I want to tell you a personal story, which is that the first time I read The Emerald Mile, I was in a study abroad in Thailand. And I was part of a group that didn't really understand me or my love of rivers. And there was kind of that homesickness and loneliness that comes with not feeling understood. And I had your book, both the way that you write and the characters that you write about. It was the shared language and value of rivers that gave me comfort so many miles from home.
You know, thanks for sharing that. That really touches me as well. And I'll share an anecdote back at you in exchange. Twice in the last 10 years since the book has come out, I've received urgent phone calls or emails from people who were asking for a signed copy of the book to be put in the mail and FedEx to them immediately. The reason behind the request was that there was someone out there, presumably a boatman, who had a deep connection to the Colorado River and Grand Canyon, and who was in hospice, dying, and wanted the book to be read to them. And sorry, this is a moment of unexpected emotion that's overtaking me. It's kind of a huge thing to have to be asked to receive a request like that and, you know, go to the post office knowing that it's really important and that the words inside of the book are very important to somebody who's in the process of leaving. But if this book speaks to people who are like in Thailand trying to remember what the rivers of the West feel like and reestablish a sense of connection with home, or if they're in hospice and they want to hear a passage about the river, what is speaking to them is not my words and my language. It's just the listening that I did all of those years ago and the words that were given to me to be put into the book and passed on to others. When people respond to this book, what they're responding to is not me. They're responding to people who are very much like them, who share their attachment and love and connection to this place, because that's what stories do.
It links with this question of why did you name the book The Emerald Mile?
That was not my original title that I had in mind. When you work with a big mainstream publisher, there are a lot of compromises that happen along the way. One of the areas in which writers have less say-so than readers might imagine is the cover of a book, including the title and the subtitle. I think that my editor felt like it wasn't just the title, but it was also the subtitle. The Emerald Mile, the epic story of the fastest ride in history through the heart of the Grand Canyon, that kind of contained the idea at the center of the book. But that's not the title that I was writing towards as I laid out 416 pages. I wanted to call it Beneath the River of Shooting Stars, Speed, Obsession, and Grace in the Grand Canyon.
It's definitely a negotiation process. I see what you mean.
One thing I should add, by the way, is that I have never been to see the actual Emerald Mile that Martin told me about, you know, that stretch of sequoias in Northern California that was slated to be logged. But I did always think that of all the Dories that Martin named, the Emerald Mile had the most beautiful name of all. And I say that without ever having seen the place itself. And the name conjures up this image in my mind of like, I mean, can you imagine an entire mile of just a ribbon of emerald created by this canopy of some of the oldest living organisms on Earth, arching over tea-colored water flowing through it? Like, it just sounds marvelous. And I always loved the name, and I hope I get a chance to go visit the place someday.
I'm getting goosebumps as you speak, and I'm also laughing a little bit inside because, so I was talking with Dave Vandermart, and one of his kayaking friends mentioned that this was like an Emerald Mile.
Mm.
But the reality is it's not a mile. It's like 2.5 miles. And it was used almost as a branding campaign.
Yeah.
Because it elicits such vivid imagery that paired with photographs is what spurred the protection of the area.
Mm. I mean, that tells me something about Dave, and I hope to meet him someday. If you want, you can call that a branding campaign and invoke the lexicon of advertising. Or you can just acknowledge that Dave and whoever was with him at the time when they came up with that name understands something about the power of poetry. Mm. I mean, there's a big difference between the Emerald Mile and the Emerald 2.5 miles. That's part of what we do, you know, when we embrace poetry. The adherence to accuracy takes a back seat to the power of language and its ability to conjure images and emotions in our mind's eye, even for those of us like myself who have never even been to the place.
Mm. The thing that I'm thinking about right now is that getting to work for the River Radius, it often feels like lots of different vignettes about how to be a conservationist, how to protect rivers. And with every episode, I get to glean like, oh, poetry as a form of activism. Photography is a form of activism.
Mm-hmm. If you apprentice yourself long enough and you learn how to wield them well enough, you can create something of beauty.
Before we meet Dave and discuss the innovative ways he got people to engage with the Emerald Mile, it's important to understand where this story takes place. To best capture the complexities, I've brought in two scientific experts from within Redwood National Park, who you'll meet more in depth in the second Emerald Mile episode. To guide us through the overlapping geographic boundaries in order to tell this story, please meet Vicky Ozaki and Leonel Aguayo.
I'm Vicky Ozaki, and I'm now retired, but I worked for Redwood National Park for about 39 years. And I was hired initially as a physical science tech when I was in college, and I spent most of my time then 100% on River Creek, surveying and looking at the effects of commercial timber harvest and road building and the effects of large floods on the channel itself. And then eventually I got a master's and was able to be hired as a geologist and worked there a long time.
My name is Leonel Arguello. I'm the deputy superintendent for Redwood National and State Parks on the National Park side. This is my 35th summer at this park. And I originally was hired on as a student biotech, completed my undergraduate and graduate degrees while working at the park. And I've been on with the park as a botanist and then as a veg manager, and then as the program manager for resources management and science, and now as deputy superintendent.
Let's talk a little bit about this place. In this interview, there's kind of a lot of different terms being thrown around. And so I think we should start by talking about how all of these geographic boundaries are connected. Let's talk about Redwood State Park, Redwood National Park, Redwood Creek, Emerald Mile, Emerald Creek. What's going on? What is this watershed?
We're in extreme Northwest California. We cooperatively manage with the California State Parks, the National Park, and three state parks, Jedediah Smith Redwoods, Delnor Coast Redwoods, and Prairie Creek State Redwoods Parks. Those three parks plus the national parks creates this unit called Redwood National and State Parks. We want to appear as a seamless single unit while we still maintain our jurisdictions for the lands that we have on the national parks and state parks, because we have to follow state rules or federal rules depending on the agency. And then shrinking down a little closer, we have three major rivers that flow through the park. In the north, Smith River. In the central part of the park, the Klamath River. And then in the southern part of the park is Redwood Creek. And within Redwood Creek is the Emerald Mile.
Redwood Creek, just for reference, the lower 40% is the National Park Service lands. And the upper 60% is private lands. And most of that is in commercial timber harvest or their ranching lands. Can I also add that Redwood Creek is about 275 plus square miles in area. And it's about a little less than 70 miles long. That drains to the northwest through the town of Ork and empties into the ocean.
I'm thinking that it would be helpful to begin with an overview of some of the bills and stages.
The three state parks were all established in the 1920s, and there was a lot of movement by the Sierra Club, the Save the Redwoods League, and a few other organizations to create a national park for the preservation and conservation of old growth redwood forest. In 1963, the National Geographic Society published an article in their magazine about the tallest trees that they have surveyed in the world. And those tallest trees occurred in Redwood Creek on a little alluvial flat that had this grove of immense voluminous redwoods. There was a gentleman who was instrumental. His name is Dave Vandermark. And Dave was working the system with Congress trying to get the Emerald Mile included in the national park, because the Emerald Mile is this stretch of Redwood Creek, basically in the heart of a remote national park, surrounded in a narrow valley on this beautiful stream with old growth on both sides of you. A lot of support goes to Dave Vandermark and his efforts of a few others to see and include the Emerald Mile as part of the original 1968 park. And he is still in the park today, reshooting photographs from 50 years ago when he had traveled in Redwood Creek originally.
It's now time to meet the man that you've been hearing about, Dave Vandermark, one of the original advocates for Redwood National Park back in the 1960s and frankly ever since. He's a photographer, but his methods of protecting the park extend well beyond that, to include helicoptering congressmen into the Emerald Mile and visiting phone booths in 100-degree weather all across California to urge people to write letters to their representatives. Dave was in the process of photographing the creek to document the changes over the last 50 years. To do this, he recruited the help of others, including John Amadio, who you'll meet in the following episode, to carry gear and pack rafts down to the creek, often on steep and sparsely used trails if there was any trails at all, for multi-day paddling trips that appear to be more portaging than paddling, in order to recreate photographs taken 50 years ago. I drove out to Humboldt County to join him and two national park experts, Johnny Mack and Brian Boatman, on what was ultimately a scouting mission for the best route down to the final creek section of this documentation project.
My name is Dave Vandermark, and we're standing in the Redwood Creek watershed.
And what are we here doing today?
Well, what we're doing today is the park folk know that I'm going to take a major trip down the gorge of Redwood Creek, and they thought that there was a slightly easier route to at least half of it. And so that's what they were doing today, guiding us down on an old trail until we're standing now above open prairie and can see down into the Redwood Creek Canyon. And from there, we'll just follow a main ridge right down to the river.
Dave, I would later learn, annotates the difference between these photos with a level of detail down to fallen limbs and the height of sediment against notable midstream boulders. After a few hours of hiking, we returned to a picnic table and began our interview. Here's Dave. There's a book by Kevin Fedarko called The Emerald Mile. Are you familiar with this book?
No.
It's a book that chronicles the fastest descent down the Grand Canyon at the time. And the reason the book is named The Emerald Mile is because that's what the boat is named. They're called dories.
Grand Canyon Dories by Martin Litton? I was invited to be an oarsman.
What?
I was, but because the battle for the park was being fought, I had to decline. I was a very, very close personal friend of Martin's. We have walked down the side of the Redwood Creek Canyon together. Martin fought really, really hard for this park.
When did he visit?
Oh, many times. He was travel editor for Sunset Magazine, and he'd fly the Sunset Magazine's Cessna up here and often take aerial pictures of Redwood Park. He supplied a lot of really, really great photos to the effort. And, of course, then he would write up an article in Sunset Magazine, and Georgia Pacific would cancel $150,000 in ads, and he'd almost lose his job. He'd have to lay low for a while. That type of thing.
Downriver Equipment is a river gear shop in Denver, Colorado, and online. Downriver has boats, oars, paddles, repair tools, custom-built frames, dry boxes, straps, drop bags, dry bags, splash gear, and PFDs. Downriver has kitchen gear, stoves, tables, coolers, water jugs, tents, sleeping bags. At the beginning of April, Downriver is hosting Raftopia, their annual gear sale with new and used gear. Raftopia culminates on Saturday, April 6th with an outdoor parking lot sales event. Find Downriver Equipment online at www.downriverequip.com and in today's show notes.
Our new sponsor is Rocky Talkie and their 5-watt radio that is waterproof and has about 2+ miles of range in river canyons and much more when line of sight is available. Rocky Talkie builds handheld radios for backcountry use to support your safety and communication. I use my Rocky Talkie 5-watt radio, this radio right here, when we run blind rapids and steep drops where some extra communication is really helpful. And what's cool is when you are done with them, turn them off for more river sounds. You want a discount code for your Rocky Talkie 5-watt radio purchase? River Radius 10 for 10% off an entire order. River Radius 10. We have their web address and the discount code in our show notes. Over and out.
Well, where I was going with this, Martin Litton's dories were named after places lost. And I found it really interesting that one of these dories was named the Emerald Mile.
The Emerald Mile, the name came from the exclamation of an individual who had fought his way down the canyon kayaking through rough, rough waters and then suddenly found himself floating in this slower flowing water. And the sunlight literally was lighting up the water in a way that gave it an emerald color. And now you're floating past this beautiful wilderness grove. It's so peaceful. He said, man, this is the Emerald Mile. I was told that story a year later when I took the boat down with Paul. I said, my God, what a story. That's a lovely name for a place. Now you got to start talking about the place. And like I said, the rocky gorge gives way to a transition where the river starts to flow. And then all of a sudden it widens and a wilderness grove appears. You see it as a place that is giving birth to the character of the lower canyon. and the story becomes bigger.
I wonder, too, how much impact the name has made. It's a beautiful name.
It is. My pride is in the Emerald Mile and that it was my story. I developed the whole concept and said, you can't just say, well, there's a lot of nice, pretty trees that are upstream. That might not get you anywhere. But if you really look into it and you find some unique things that are going on and you really see them as special and you start talking about them as though they're special, you all of a sudden raise the opportunity for its protection. And to me, that whole idea of calling just another piece of Redwood Creek the Emerald Mile, just that alone, kind of has something magical about it. I want to think that I was basically the person that did that. And my friend John Almedillo, who was equally active at trying to protect the side valley that they called Emerald Creek.
Would you talk a little bit about how that creek affected you?
When I got up here and spent a year at the university and learned about the hints of a redwood park were starting, the tall trees had been discovered. I met these beautiful people that were the major activists at the time. And then I had been invited to take this long boat trip the length of the river. And that changed my life.
What about it in particular?
I was floating through wilderness that I was told was going to be logged. And that just broke my heart, made me angry. I felt you now had a responsibility to talk about it. I was amazed that at 21 years of age, I was already one of the handful of people that had been able to see how it transitioned from a rocky gorge to a wide open river with mature redwood forest groves. You literally were watching evolution. But as you floated the river, you came upon this long stretch that had been completely clear cut, and you could see the handwriting on the wall. You knew what was going to happen if a park was not created. And so I was ready to be involved.
They say that we don't choose our campaigns. In this case, the river chose you. But you paddled it with others. Why didn't they join you? Why weren't they involved?
Oh, you're talking about the 1965 trip all the way down Redwood Creek. The trip was actually the contribution of the oarsman, Paul Gearslane. He knew about the impending park issue. And he brought along a professional photographer and a forester, Dr. Rudolph Becking at Humboldt State University. And then I was invited as a young environmentalist. It was his idea of taking this professional photographer down the river, taking this forester down the river, that they would build the case for Redwood Creek. But I don't think the man personally became greatly involved. Although 2 years later, we went down the river again in that boat. We were bringing Norman Livermore, the head of natural resources for the state of California, down to show him damage being carried on by the lumber companies that they said they weren't doing. Paul helped carry that one out, too. But it was amazing that when I was at Humboldt State, I became known as Mr. Redwood. You know, I didn't have a relationship because I loved trees more than girls. And you got a lot of support that would eventually write a letter or doing things. But in terms of going out into the woods all the time, if three or four or five of us were in the woods at one time, that was a crowd. A lot of times it was just me sneaking out to photograph something and then get back. I lived at the southern end of Eureka at that time. And I was being taught how to work in a darkroom in Oreck. So after school was over, I would drive at 8 o'clock at night, drive to Oreck, develop the film, try and make a picture or two, leave that little darkroom at 11 o'clock at night and get home at midnight and then get up for an 8 o'clock class at Humboldt, I didn't do very well in school.
And what is the consequence of clear cutting? What impact does it have on the river or the watershed?
To be silly about it, you lose some gorgeous big old trees. Beyond that, the way they clear cut, they used the largest bulldozers that were known to man. The gigantic D9 bulldozer could just clear away 2 or 3 feet of 1,000-year-old soil in just a heartbeat. First off, they took the soft soil and created little mounds periodically that they would fall the big trees into. And then they would buck the trees into logs, and then they would drag all these logs down to a landing area where they could be loaded on trucks. Well, bulldozers just literally crisscross like ants, just completely ripping away 60, 70, 80% of the entire soil layer. And then when the rains came, down into the watershed it goes. The erosion is tremendous. I mean, there was a lot of massive land movement, somewhat small scale. But collectively, when you're talking about 5, 10, 12, 15,000 acres of land all being logged at the same time, the damage is tremendous.
Something that I appreciate about this story is that the Emerald Mile is not known for its rapids. You know, the Stanislaus was class 2, class 3. The American, one of the most popular stretches now, class 3. But the Emerald Mile isn't known for that.
I like to say the Emerald Mile was a real place and a story. And it's not even a mile, it's multi-miles. It was speaking about the most intact area that could be protected at that time. Every other part of Redwood Creek downstream below the Emerald Mile had been impacted significantly in one way or another. So it represented literally an ecological unit and not just the flowing water. In other words, we were talking about the entire landscape.
Was there a moment when you realized that you were going to be a person to stand up and say something?
I first off thought of myself mainly as a documenter. I mean, I was the one that raced out quite frequently with camera in hand, either on the ground or from an airplane. I was witnessing the demolition of our area that we wanted to save. Don't forget, we didn't have the internet, we didn't have computers, we didn't have any way to transmit pictures. I had to print something and put them in the mail to the Sierra Club in San Francisco. But as time went on, you wanted to stimulate other people. You wanted people to help you. So I was on talk shows and I had to go to city council meetings. Everybody knew who I was. I could walk a sidewalk in Eureka and some man would walk by me that I had no idea who he was, and he would say, "Hi, Dave." Actually, that was kind of uncomfortable for me. That was not a role that I felt I was good at. I was not a good offhand speaker. I did my best, because if you believe in what you believe, the whole idea is you got to convey that belief to somebody else to get something to happen.
What's the benefit of being a documentarian? What role did your photographs play in getting people to see the value of what you were saying?
A picture is worth a thousand words. The Sierra Club and other organizations were testifying before Congress, but you still had to have direct evidence coming from the landscape itself directly to the public in the form of TV shows and newspaper articles, to where they could get a real feel for what was happening. All of those papers publishing photographs of clear cutting and also photographs of redwood trees so massive that they're almost unbelievable in size, those images, they helped immensely. I was told at one time that Redwood National Park garnered more letters to Congress than the Kennedy assassination. Redwood National Park was generating that sort of response from the public.
I understand this section of creek to be incredibly remote, where not a lot of people are able to see it. And photography is a way to allow people to experience it.
That's correct. What we had to do, in fact, there was a House hearing held in 1967 in the spring by the House Interior Committee, then chairman by a man, Wayne Aspinall, who was the very man that kept the Wilderness Act from taking place for almost 10 years. We had a luncheon event hosted by the timber companies, of course. And prior to that, we had communicated with some of the congressmen that were there. Would you be willing to ride a helicopter up the canyon and be dropped off in the middle of the Emerald Mile and see it? And about a half a dozen of them said yes. There was a man who's now long passed away, who had a flying service in Eureka. And so there, right when we're having this luncheon, in comes a helicopter landing in the channel. So I get in it and take off, and he takes me to the one part of the Emerald Mile. The river just literally opens up real wide, and there's a really giant sandbar. So we landed on that. I get out, and I say, you bring the congressman here. And so one by one, they'd get out of the helicopter, and I would then tell them a little bit about the Emerald Mile. And I just pushed every one of them into the grove, and I said, just go and enjoy yourself. All five were taken by it. So at the hearing the next day in Eureka, over 100 people testified that they wanted the Emerald Mile added to the bill. Well, all the congressmen came to me and told me what a wonderful experience they had had. And when they got back to Washington, they all told their chairman that they want to mark the bill up and it's got to include that Emerald Mile in it. But amazingly, I mean, and this is really, really unusual, after the entire House committee had approved the boundaries, again, we're talking about the 1968 park boundaries with just a narrow little corridor coming up the river to the tall trees and now going 6 more miles up the river to include all of the Emerald Mile. Well, Wayne Aspinall by himself rewrote the bill and removed the Emerald Mile and then put it before the floor of the House, which voted on it, not having, I guess, any idea that a change had been made. The committee had approved something different. Now the Senate bill differed from the House bill, and so a conference committee had to convene to reconcile the difference. And of all things, in the 2nd District of California, with one congressman, and his name was Biz Johnson, I think he was a Democrat, very conservative, and would ordinarily have voted the way that Wayne Aspinall wanted him to. But I drove 1,500 miles in his district, getting into a phone booth and calling members who lived in his district to call him and write him. And he got so inundated with letters and phone calls and whatnot that he voted right. So the Senate package got approved in conference, and that's what was signed into law.
Were there letter-writing campaigns? Were people writing letters on their own accord? Were they being asked? Was your photography a part of it?
You were talking to people you did not know and asking them to, in their own words, in their own way, to just contact Congressman Biz Johnson and tell him to vote for the Senate bill.
And when you say you, who were you collaborating with?
Alone. I drove 1,800 miles in about 30 days, stayed at various people's homes or in cheap motels, but otherwise got out of my little Datsun pickup truck and then got into these hot phone booths. And it was 100 degrees outside, and I'm dropping quarters into these phone booths to make cold. It was a miserable trip.
Gosh, one man band driving all over it. That's just incredible. Did you have opposition?
Thankfully, the only opposition I had was somebody using the phone booth. I drove from, you know, Bishop and all the way to the Oregon line and to the Nevada line. up Interstate 80, all of those little communities. I was stopping at every one of them.
And what happened next?
After the conference committee resolved, that provides the bill for the president's signature, and we created a park at that time.
Sometimes in victories, everyone celebrates and then goes home and kind of puts the topic on the shelf. Did you stay engaged?
Can I tell you a story about what I did on the day that it became law?
Yes.
I drove my little car. I don't quite know where I parked. So I walked into the Emerald Mile, and I walked the length of Redwood Creek. I walked about 10 miles. And then when I got back to my car, I drove into Oreck, and there was a saloon there. I go in it, and there are about a half a dozen loggers sitting at the bar. And a man by the name of Tommy Dorsey, he was a supervisor at the time, and he was the owner of the bar. He grudgingly came over and said, "What do I want?" You know, I said, "I want a beer." Well, all the loggers are looking over at me. One of them came over and said, "Can you help us understand what's now in the park around Oreck?" And I was asked that very nicely. So we laid a map out on the pool table, and I tried to describe the best I could all the places that were taken. And in the meantime, this Pat Dorsey is marching back and forth between the bar on the slatted woodwork that kind of makes a creaky, banging noise. And he started to interrupt our very cordial discussion. And so one of the loggers turned around and finally just looked back at Dorsey and said, "Dorsey, shut up." We finished going over the map. I shook hands with every one of the men and wished them well. And drove home.
Do you know what ended up happening to them? How are they affected?
Well, most of them still very much had their job. We just took a little narrow wedge of that eastern side. So there were thousands and thousands and thousands of acres of beautiful old growth forest just waiting for their chainsaw.
You may remember that this episode began with Kevin Fedarko and the naming of his book and the Dorys. Here's a reminder.
Each Dory in Martin's fleet was named after a natural wonder that had been destroyed or irreparably impaired by the hand of human beings.
So even after Dave Vandermark's thousands of miles and letters and photographs, how is the Emerald Mile lost at the hand of man? We've been talking about the original boundary, which implies that there's a change. What were some of the reasons for the expansion of the park?
The original park was being destroyed. The channel of Redwood Creek was filling up with gravels to where the gravels were almost coming to the very level of the Tall Trees Grove itself. And normally, groves of redwood trees only got periodically flooded by maybe historically high water. Now, the entire channel of Redwood Creek was within a foot or two of the level of the grove, and so a horrendous storm of any kind could have just wiped it out.
In your writing, the original park, is this where you describe it as the worm?
Yes.
Can you walk us through why you called it that?
Well, you know, I'm not the maker of the word worm, but that became the popular vernacular. I mean, just to protect one quarter of a mile on either side, it's just virtually nothing when you look at some of these side canyons miles long. I mean, they were going to be able to log 90 to 95% of almost every watershed flowing into the river. The worm is kind of an ugly word, and I think that was a good snide remark about how little protection Redwood Creek was being given by that narrow corridor.
But then all of that uphill forest is subject to logging, and that's why you get the soil coming down and clogging some of the streams. That's why you get the like loose soil that's creating these gullies.
Correct. So you had the quarter mile completely protected. There was a so-called 800-foot buffer that initially the timber companies weren't operating in, but they were just massively clear-cutting as much as they could, as fast as they could, down to that 800-foot buffer. And then they said, all right, now we're going to start cutting little patch cuts in that buffer right down to that original worm boundary. The thousands of acres of contiguous logging was just causing too much damage.
When you think about lessons learned from this campaign, what comes to mind?
Short-sightedness. Saving a block of wilderness and spending the bucks on it, as opposed to spending 10 times more money putting it back together again. I mean, we literally have spent millions upon millions upon millions of dollars repairing damage that was done by a private company, and they should have put it back together. And so we lost the original forest, we lost the ecosystem, because we were so short-sighted to look really ahead.
And you can't have it back. You know, old growth forests, they only come around once in a while.
We're talking about thousands of years to bring back an old growth forest environment. There are thousands of acres of Redwood National Park that you could call it waiting for another time Redwood Park. But we're not looking at a 20-foot diameter tree, we're looking at a 1-foot diameter tree. Mankind just has to wait it out.
A phone booth size thank you goes out to Kevin Fidarco and Dave Vandemark for sharing your story with us. Thank you Vicky Izaki, Leonel Arguello, Brian Boatman, and Johnny Mack for sharing your time with the River Radius, and thank you Matthew Brown for the idea to tell this story. Part 2 of the Emerald Mile details the effort to expand, manage, and restore Redwood Creek and the Emerald Mile, and poses deeper philosophical questions on when a landscape is truly lost. As always, you can find more resources in our show notes and on our social media page. I'm Samara Rosen. Thanks for listening to the River Radius podcast.
Thank you to Samara Rosen for this episode. The second episode in this series will publish on April 2nd. You can find out more about Samara and her work at her website, readingwater.org. We have two sponsors today, Downriver Equipment and their Raftopia event. Raftopia is happening April 6th, online and in person. And Rocky Talkies are also our sponsor today. Use the promo code RIVERRADIUS10 for 10% off your entire order with Rocky Talkie. You can find links for both sponsors in the show notes and on our website. All River Radius social media is organized by Samantha Seiss. All River Radius music comes from the lap steel guitar of Gene Reiniger. Be in touch anytime. hello@theriverradius.com. Thanks so much for joining the River Radius.
Oh, you mean the tan oak right here?
Well, it's just right past home place, but before you get to the barn, where the road drops down and you have to make a tight turn around it.
Right here.
Yeah.
That's a bay. It's a bay tree.
That's a bay. That's
a bay. Yeah.
It's so special.
It is. It's got the big conks in it.
Yeah.
I know. It is very special.